Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 15th of July, these are our main stories. Aid workers in Sudan have given details of an increasingly desperate humanitarian situation in North Darfur. Striking Hollywood actors have joined picket lines outside studios in Los Angeles at the start of their most serious strike in decades. And
what a beast. 250,000 tons, 365 metres long, 20 decks, 5,600 passengers, 2,350 crew. It is a floating city, this thing.
We hear about the world's biggest cruise ship, which sets sail in the Caribbean next year. Also in this podcast, the Russian Parliament bans gender reassignment surgery and why shops in the UK are being urged not to sell a mafia-themed whiskey, which comes in a bottle shaped like a machine gun. In the early 2000s, the Darfur region of Sudan was synonymous with human rights abuses. Many likened the killing of hundreds of thousands of people there at the hands of Arab militias to genocide. Now the area is once again the focus of violence, with the medical charity MSF describing an increasingly desperate humanitarian situation in North Darfur. It said more than 300 people had died in the state capital El Fasher since the conflict started in April. Our Africa editor Richard Hamilton told me about the situation there.
Today we've been trying to get through to the doctors in North Darfur in the city of El Fasher, Mohamed Al Faki, but the connection's too bad. But he has sent a written account. It's really heartbreaking. He says that despite assurances of a ceasefire, the paramilitary is still attacking the city. He says there are roadblocks, people are afraid to get out. The central market has been closed, people can't get into banks, and there's particularly desperate situation in terms of medical supplies.
And Richard, there's violence across many parts of Sudan, but why is it so intense in this part of the country?
Experts are saying that the paramilitary, which is the sort of reincarnation of the Janjaweed, the Arab militia, are really determined to drive out the African ethnic groups, to almost create a new Arab-only state. These paramilitary under Hemeti, the leader, they just feel that it's all or nothing now. They don't want to even form a government. They just want to destroy the African people living in Darfur. So it's that bad.
Richard Hamilton. Well, on Thursday, the International Criminal Court began investigating alleged war crimes under an existing mandate for Darfur dating back to 2005. And that probe led to genocide charges against Sudan's former president, Omar al-Bashir. Mercy Juma has been to neighbouring Chad, where she met refugees who told her about the atrocities they'd witnessed.
Carrying what little they have, these families have just crossed the border from Sudan to Chad. They are joining over 170,000 refugees who are living in camps along the frontier after fleeing ethnic fighting that has erupted in Darfur. Among them, a man too scared to reveal his identity, who has evidence of one of the most shocking incidents of the conflict. Pictures taken on his phone before he fled Darfur show dead bodies scattered in streets. Many appear to be civilians who have been burned, aid agency facilities wrecked, and perhaps most disturbingly, bodies dumped from a lorry into a mass grave. He says he was part of a group that removed corpses after fighting saw the rapid support forces seize control of parts of the city of El Junaina.
We removed the bodies of the dead who were killed by the RSF or the Arab militias backed by the RSF. We went towards the forest graveyard to bury the bodies, but the RSF refused to bury the bodies there. Under the orders of the RSF, the driver of the truck dumped the bodies in the pit.
He says the decision to dump the bodies in a mass grave was a deliberate act of disrespect.
These people were Muslims who should have been buried in a graveyard with all the rituals, but unfortunately, the RSF, you could see desire for revenge in their eyes.
In April, fighting erupted in Sudan as a power struggle within the country's military leadership pitted the army against the paramilitary rapid support forces. RSF has its origins in the Arab militia that brutally suppressed a rebellion by black African groups in 2003, resulting in accusations of ethnic cleansing and genocide. The recent fighting has allowed the conflict in Darfur to reignite. The violence doesn't appear to be random.
My name is Mujib al-Rahman Muhammad Yaqub Rizik. I am the leader of Masalid tribe.
Members of the black African groups say Arab groups have systematically attacked them.
This is a genocide because all the Masalid leader has been target, the lawyers, teachers, doctors.
Members of black African communities say attacks like these against both community leaders and ordinary people are why tens of thousands of people have fled the fighting.
Refugee camps in Chad are just a symptom of the violence that is happening across the border in Darfur, Sudan. We have heard stories of targeted killings and robberies, official buildings being burnt down and looted. And this is just the latest episode of ethnically targeted violence in a long-running crisis that has seen years of death and destruction.
Mercy Juma with that report from Chad. No one will be left behind in our efforts to ensure affordable, plentiful food for every Nigerian. That's a tweet from the President, Bola Tinubu, as he announced a state of emergency because of food shortages and rising prices. Well, the situation has been made worse by the removal of fuel subsidies and the dire security situation in the north, where many farms are located. So how difficult is it for Nigerians now, and what can the President do to help? Our reporter Azizat Ola Oluwa spoke to me from Abuja.
About 133 million people, 60% of the population, are multidimensionally poor. Many people wake up every day and don't even know where they would get their next meal from. And these people have children. They can't even feed their children. The minimum wage is about $65. And that's what many people are taking home every month. And since this fuel subsidy removal, the fuel prices increment has caused the prices of food items to be increased astronomically. Rice, bread, almost every food item has been affected. And the income of Nigerians remain the same. And that is why organized labor is still in discussion with the government for them to increase minimum wage.
So what measures is the president announcing to solve the problem for people?
So the first thing is to solve the problem of insecurity. Farmers are not being able to go to their farm to work. And there are reports that some of these bandits are even asking for farmers to pay taxes for them to be allowed to work. And also they say that they are going to deploy some of the monies they've been able to gain from fuel subsidy removal and inject that into the agricultural sector.
But it's quite long term, isn't it? I mean, if you're an ordinary Nigerian, you're saying, look, I can't afford the rice that I need to feed my family now.
What they are going to do now is to disburse about $10 to 12 million households every month for the next 6 months. How helpful that is going to be is another question, because people are saying, what can this buy? You know, a bag of rice in Nigeria is about $65. People are saying it's ridiculous. But the question is, how will these 12 million households be identified? Because there have been lots of scandals around initial programs of conditional money transfer to people during COVID-19, then, you know, other programs trying to cushion the effect of inflation. And people will tell you that they never saw this. Nigerians always ask you, let us see these people you say you keep giving this money to.
Azizat Ola Oluwa there. Hollywood is on strike. Tens of thousands of actors have walked out of their jobs to join film and television writers in the first industry-wide stoppage in more than 60 years. This actor was part of the picket lines in Los Angeles.
The working class actor is, in fact, working class. Celebrities make up a very small portion of the Screen Actors Guild membership. In fact, there was a statistic released recently that over 80% of its members do not qualify for health care. That's a staggering number when you consider the amount of entertainment that is consumed worldwide.
Well, the BBC's Regan Morris also spoke to me from a picket line in LA.
I'm outside Warner Brothers on the picket line, and this is one of many across town in New York and Los Angeles where the writers and actors are picketing in solidarity also with other union members.
There's a lot of hooting going on of car horns. Do you get the feeling that people are hooting in solidarity with them?
Yeah, definitely. They ask for you to honk. They want you to honk. Warner Brothers in the city have actually put up signs about warning people about noise ordinance, saying don't honk your horns. So, yes, the horns are definitely in support of the writers and actors as they go by.
And, Reagan, what kind of knock-on effect is this going to have on the blockbusters in production, do you think?
It's shut it down, and there's still some reality TV going on. Some shows may not ever come back. I mean, that's what happened in the last strike. You just really can't predict.
I mean, some of the big stars are lending their support to this strike, but not everyone is backing the strikers.
Well, I think most people in this town are, except for the CEOs. And there's a lot of people already really hurting in Los Angeles and New York and film centers that, you know, people that work in the crews and that haven't worked for a while. But they understand. They understand this affects everyone, I think, in the film industry, because if they can make writers and actors with AI, they don't need the camera crew or really the craft services. So it really affects the whole economy of cities like Los Angeles, which relies so heavily on it. The last strike, I believe it cost $2 billion is what they've estimated to the economy here. So it could really have a big impact. And this one's much bigger.
That was Reagan Morris in LA. Well, the shutdown will affect all productions employing members of the Screen Actors Guild, not just in the US, but globally as well. Many Hollywood films and series shot in the UK will be hit, and actors in this country have been told that they could face the sack if they strike in sympathy. Well, the British actress Ajoa Ando is probably best known as Lady Danbury in the Netflix hit Bridgerton and Queen Charlotte. She's been telling Martha Carney why the industry is in crisis.
On both sides of the pond, we are in the middle of a financial crisis, as we all know. At the same time as that's happening, we have the absolute flourishing of the streaming services, which, you know, I and Bridgerton have benefited from hugely. And we have AI. And our industry is quite a fragile industry. If you're hugely successful, maybe not so. But if you are pottering along in the middle or on the margins, you really need to know that there's a base level of pay that you can survive at. You need to know that your repeat fees, your residuals, as they call them in America, will come through. There's a particular set of circumstances in America where if you don't reach a certain financial threshold, I think it's $26,000, you don't get your health insurance. And for many people who are puttering along, getting the residuals is a way that they get their health insurance. You need those sorts of parameters. And so I think what's happening at the moment is people are coming together to stand in solidarity and say we need a base level of financial security.
That's on the pay side of the argument. You also mentioned AI, artificial intelligence. And how much of a worry is that for actors?
It's the same existential worry. You know, we work in the realm of creativity and imagination. And if it becomes cheaper to have a machine do a sort of simulation of that creativity and imagination, then we could be toast, which we don't want. And there's a level of work that we make which is different. I would say it speaks at a soul level. And so we want to make sure that that's protected for us as creative human beings, but also for the quality of the work.
Ajoa Ando speaking to Martha Carney. As you heard in our earlier podcast, India's latest attempt to join the superpowers of the space race blasted off from the southern state of Andhra Pradesh. Almost 4 years after its first attempt failed, India is trying again to become the fourth nation to successfully land a rover on the surface of the moon. Well, our correspondent Arundhati Mukherjee was at the small coastal island of Sriharikota to witness the launch of the Chandrayaan 3 rocket.
3, 2, 1, 0. India's third lunar mission, blazing into the sky.
If Indian scientists do manage to achieve that soft landing on the lunar surface, India will become only the fourth nation in the world to have achieved that feat, up there with the likes of the US, China and Russia.
Congratulations, India.
Chandrayaan 3 has started its journey towards moon.
That was a delighted head of India's space program, S. Somnath, speaking to the media soon after the launch. The Chandrayaan 3 module is due to land in late August. That will be the real test for the mission.
Normal performance was observed.
Because memories from a launch 4 years ago still weigh heavily on Indian scientists.
The communication from lander to ground station was lost.
That mission, Chandrayaan 2, failed when its landing went wrong. and it crashed on the lunar surface. But past failures didn't stop the excitement for the thousands of Indians who had flocked from across the country to see the launch.
I always get goosebumps. From my childhood, I've been watching this in launches in TV. And we never got any opportunity to come and witness this personally. When we got it, it is definitely a historic moment.
India's latest moon mission is carrying with it not just a lander and a rover, but the hopes of millions of Indians as well.
Arundhati Mukherjee with that report. Now, you may or may not have seen the world's largest cruise ship yet. I've been looking online and it is extremely large indeed. It's been named the Icon of the Seas. Its owner, Royal Caribbean International, describes the liner as a game changer for vacations. It's due to set sail in Caribbean waters in January 2024. And James Reynolds spoke to Alex Rhodes, who's been on a sister ship to this new mammoth vessel.
What a beast, first of all. It's 250,000 tons, 365 metres long, 20 decks, 8 neighbourhoods, as they call it. Areas, almost like, think of Disneyland, things like that. Capacity of 5,600 passengers, 2,350 crew. It is a floating city, this thing.
It sounds almost a country.
Yeah, its biggest boast is that it's the largest water park at sea. So it's got 6 water slides, as well as 7 swimming pools, 9 whirlpools.
You've been on a similar ship.
So I was on the Mariner of the Seas, the same company that all their ships have of the seas on. It was maybe half the weight or something like that, and it was still the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was huge. Like, you see these things when you're on the beach and things like that in the distance. Only when they're close up at port do you get the sense of the scale of these things.
Did you need a map on board?
Yes. One of the first things they do is kind of the orientation, where they sort of tell you this is where you go. I was on when I was 12 or 13 because we went on a family holiday and we got it cheap because it was during hurricane season, which did play a part in the holiday later on.
Yeah, I bet.
But it was just mammoth. I mean, it had an ice rink. I think it had 2 cinemas. One of the decks, you go down and you sort of come out in the elevators. And they've done it up to make it look like a high street. They've cobbled the floor and they've made shops inside to make it look like a street. It was so bizarre.
They're trying to make it look like land then inside. But what's the point if you want to go to sea to enjoy the sea and you end up on cobbled streets?
It's basically, yeah, sea travel for people who hate the ocean. They're so big, these things. They're, you know, you're not designed to be able to feel seasick or anything. But once they start rolling, you can feel it a bit.
Back to the Icon of the Seas, the gargantuan one that we were first talking about. One of the things that struck many people looking at those pictures is how multicoloured it is.
Well, I think partly they want to go a bit younger. You know, cruise ships have a bit of a reputation of having an older clientele, and they want to attract families. And part of that is making it big, colourful, getting young people on board. And this water park is something for the kids to do while the adults basically eat and drink. That's the other thing I've got to say. When I was on the Mariner, it was just eating and drinking nonstop. You go down to these huge buffets where you can have anything you want, whenever. You know, the Venus de Mayo, you know that sculpture, the armless Greek sculpture?
Yes, that's right.
They had one of them made out of chilled butter.
Alex, there have been big debates in recent years in some ports around the world about the fact that they don't want these huge cruise ships to dock where they are. Where does that debate stand around the world at the moment?
It definitely seems to be more of a thing in, I would say, Mediterranean ports, partly because you're talking about old European cities who were not built with these things in mind. The Caribbean islands, again, it's similar really, but like they stop off in different parts. One way that Royal Caribbean, this company, has got a way around it is buy an island. They own an island called Coco Cay, which is for their exclusive use. They dock up there and passengers go down and don't have those pesky locals getting in the way.
That was the BBC's Alex Rhodes. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. AI brings a Brazilian musical star back to life and stokes controversy. US lawmakers have narrowly approved President Biden's latest defense budget in the face of opposition from members of his own party. In a highly unusual move, House Democrats opposed the legislation, which passed by 219 votes to 210, after Republicans added provisions related to abortion funding and transgender medical care. From Washington, David Willis has the details.
Approval of the annual defence budget is normally a formality, but this year, Republicans who hold the majority in the House of Representatives sought to weave into the legislation amendments that would roll back diversity programmes and end funding for abortion and transgender medical care. The National Defence Authorisation Act, as it's known, constitutes more than $880 billion in spending on pay rises, new equipment and aid for Ukraine, but virtually every Democrat voted against it. The controversial amendments are almost certain to be scuppered by the Democrat-led Senate, however, which is due to begin considering its version of the budget next week.
To Russia now, where trans activists are up in arms after Parliament passed a law banning gender reassignment surgery. The new rule that's gone through the lower house also stops parents who transition gender from adopting children. The BBC's Olga Ivshina from the Russian service told me more about this new law.
It's actually just a continuation of a series of laws introduced by Russian officials, which, to cut a long story short, makes it, first of all, illegal and then almost physically impossible to undergo sex changes in Russia. And even to publicly identify yourself as a gay or as a transgender. So it started first with some minor initiatives, but now it looks as a full-scale crackdown on transgender people.
And this new law with regards to the transgender community was passed by all the MPs. What kind of reaction has there been inside Russia from the public to it?
That's a good question, and the one which is really hard to answer. The current legislation makes it almost illegal to discuss this question freely in public. So even someone risks to talk about it publicly, say a newspaper or a TV station, they take huge risks letting those people to speak out. So almost the only voice which is currently heard within Russia is the voice of those traditionalists or ultra-traditionalists. And those people got a lot of public coverage over the past years, and their position is even more boosted since the start of Russia's invasion into Ukraine. I mean, the war itself has no direct connotations with this law, but the invasion was just another excuse to increase crackdown on LGBT, to increase crackdown on freedom of speech. So all those criticizing the law have to speak from outside Russia, including independent media outlets, which were also forced to leave since the start of Russia's invasion into Ukraine.
Olga, more broadly, being gay in Russia is not easy, is it? There's a lot of discrimination, possible assault as well. What's it like being transgender in Russia?
It's extremely complicated. People who are transgender in Russia, it's not only young and well-educated people from Moscow and St. Petersburg who have access to, Western media. And sometimes it's people from tiny villages lost on the vast landscapes of Russia. For example, there is a famous story of Yevgeny Sapayev. She was born as a male, but then she started to understand that she feels as a woman. So in 2013, she took painkillers and at home herself tried to sex trade herself, tried to change herself at home manually. She prepared well enough so she didn't die. But of course, eventually she was hospitalized and doctors helped to finish that surgery. She continued her life for some time, but unfortunately in 2018, she was beaten to death in Moscow because of the way she looked. I think this story, it just shows how stressful, how risky, and how dreadful, basically, it is to be a transgender person in Russia.
Olga Ivshina from the BBC Russian service. Food and drinks manufacturers try all sorts of gimmicks to sell their wares. Beer-infused pizza, rosé wine in a pair of glass stiletto boots, to name but two. But one whisky company has taken things too far. The UK's alcohol regulator has asked shops to stop ordering a mafia-themed bottle of Scotch whisky shaped like a machine gun. It said it was likely to cause widespread offence. James Shaw takes up the story.
Cosa Nostra whisky comes in a black box with images of bullet holes on it. The bottle itself is shaped like a Thompson submachine gun, a weapon associated with Italian-American gangsters. The packaging also carries a Latin saying which roughly translates as "to the victor the spoils." The Portman Group said the packaging made a direct connection between the drink and a dangerous weapon. Its chief executive, Matt Lambert, described that as completely inappropriate.
Obviously, we've had recently some very high-profile
and unfortunate cases of gun crime, and in areas where gun crime is a problem, it could definitely cause a lot of concern, offence, and great unease.
The company, Bartex Bartol, has not responded to the complaint. Earlier today, the whisky was still apparently being sold by some online retailers for more than £60 a bottle. But Matt Lambert said action taken some years ago against another product from the same company had been effective. Red Army vodka was sold in a bottle shaped like a Kalashnikov assault rifle. The Scotch Whisky Association, which represents whisky companies in Scotland, welcomed the Portman Group's decision. It said Bartex Bartol was not one of its members and its legal affairs team was investigating the product.
James Shaw. A TV advertisement for Volkswagen's 70th birthday in Brazil has divided the nation. In the 10 days since it first aired, the YouTube version has been watched more than 16 million times. Rachel Wright has more.
The sound of mother and daughter singing a duet in Portuguese on a TV advertisement for Volkswagen's 70th anniversary. The woman on the left of the screen, the 45-year-old Maria Rita, singing as she drives a modern-looking yellow VW upright car. The one on the right of the screen, her 30-something mother, Ellis Regina, singing while she drives an old-style VW camper van. The trouble is, Ellis Regina had a heart attack and died in 1982 at the age of 36. Brazil's First Lady, Rosângela Lula da Silva, tweeted, "It's 7-something in the morning and I'm bawling my eyes out," one of many Brazilians who said they were moved to tears by the performance. Ellis Regina had been credited with beginning the era of Brazilian popular music, her album Arrastão selling over 1 million copies. So how and why was she brought back to life? Well, VW cars are ubiquitous in Brazil, so the company wanted to do something really special for its 70th anniversary. And what could be better than bringing the country's most beloved singer back from the dead? So they spent 2,500 hours using facial recognition software on a lookalike actress to give the impression that the singer was actually there. But not everyone was happy with the resurrection of Ellis. Newspapers and social media have been filled with discomfort and in some cases outrage, and mostly because Ellis herself couldn't approve it. VW says it has the blessing of the singer's family, and of course her daughter appeared in the commercial. But this week the advertising watchdog Conar announced it would investigate a possible break of ethics after receiving complaints about using such methods. And Ellis's son, João Marcelo Boscolo, who was only 11 when his mother died from a heart attack after consuming cocaine, vermouth and tranquilizers, feels the advert will introduce the singer to a whole new generation of people. "Listen to her because you will like it and it will move you," he said.
Volkswagen 70 anos. Sucesso que passa de geração em geração.
Rachel Wright. He's been hailed as a genius and the perfect director by actors. Now, Christopher Nolan, who also writes the screenplay for many of his movies, has told the BBC that he won't write another film until the actors and writers' strike that we reported on earlier in this podcast is resolved. The acclaimed British director was speaking ahead of the premiere of his latest film, Oppenheimer. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, met Christopher Nolan.
The Trinity test in 1945. A bomb created by scientists working for the US government and used controversially to end World War II. Dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, one of the world's most renowned film directors, Christopher Nolan, is telling the story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist behind the bomb and that test.
I knew that he was father of the atomic bomb, and I knew there was more to the story. And it's this moment where the lead scientists of the Manhattan Project, led by Robert Oppenheimer, realise that they can't fully eliminate the possibility of a chain reaction that would set fire to the atmosphere and destroy the entire world when they detonate that first test at Trinity.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
I became really interested in exploring that moment where they made that incredible decision. You know there's a possibility that when you push that button, you might destroy the entire world. And yet they went ahead and they pushed it.
Making the bomb was a triumph of human ingenuity and science, but it also began a potentially deadly arms race. Here's Oppenheimer quoting from Hindu scripture in 1965.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
He never apologized for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He was extremely cautious in the way he talked about it. And yet, all of his actions post-1945, to me, are the actions of somebody racked by guilt. And it's that disparity between what he allowed the world to see outwardly and what seems to have been driving him that I wanted to drill down on. And it's what makes his story the most dramatic I've ever encountered.
What was your process and your thinking when you were recreating that moment of the atom bomb first detonating on film?
It's very clear that the Trinity test has to be the showstopper. You know, we were out in the desert the way they were for the real Trinity test. We recreated the circumstances of it. Because what we're trying to portray is this moment of absolute beauty and absolute terror.
The film's stars appeared at the premiere in London last night. But as the news came that actors would be joining writers on the picket lines, they left before the film started. Nolan, who writes his own movies, is already on strike.
A lot of people are going to suffer.
So you will not be writing another film while this strike is on?
No, absolutely. It's very important that everybody understand that it is a very, very key moment in the relationship between working people in Hollywood. And this is not about me. This is about jobbing actors. This is about staff writers on television programs trying to raise a family, trying to be able to keep food on the table. And these companies have not yet accommodated how they're going to, in this new world of streaming, pay appropriately the union's working members.
Oppenheimer is the latest to take on big themes. And with the film focused on the nuclear arms race, what does he think of the other existential threat to humankind, AI?
When you talk to leaders in the field of AI, as I do from time to time, they see this moment right now as their Oppenheimer moment. They refer to it as their Oppenheimer moment. They're looking to his story to say, okay, what are our responsibilities? How can we deal with the potential of unintended consequences? What Oppenheimer did was he gave us the power to destroy ourselves. It didn't exist before, and it will never go away. It irrevocably changed life on Earth.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.
There are ethical lessons for the future in this timely film about a scientific genius whose actions irrevocably changed life on Earth.
Katie Razzle was speaking to Christopher Nolan there. And that archive of Robert Oppenheimer comes from White Paper, The Decision to Drop the Bomb by NBC and Encyclopedia Britannica Films. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.